or the destruction of the world as we know it. And just as Harry Potter was using it, what he also too was Philip Pullman's series, although, as he alludes to here, very different. And there's kind of irony in play here that if you were kind of alive at the time and paid attention, when Harry Potter was being published, there was some controversy about, in very conservative religious groups, about whether this was a bad thing, the children to be reading about witchcraft and white magic and so on. The irony being that when you read the Harry Potter series, it's actually a very straightforward Christian-ish tale of redemption, of sacrifice and heroism and loyalty and so on, and a kind of fairly uncomplicatedly Christian, at least in worldview, series written by J.K. Rowling, who herself was a kind of church-attending Christian of one form or another. So the irony is that Harry Potter got the attention, and meanwhile, Philip Pullman wrote this extraordinary series that generated some, but not heaps of controversy, although its central story is not about, as in Harry Potter, the young wizard who lays down his life to defeat evil and save the school, but about a little girl whose quest involves, in some sense, ultimately transpires in the killing of God, not metaphorically, but literally, that's what happens in the book. And so, among the many things that Philip Pullman has pulled off, I think it's been extraordinary that he managed to get that plot line under the radar while everyone was railing about Harry Potter. So I thought this is a really worthwhile thing to think about. As a Christian, I'm a Christian, and I really came, whether you're a Christian or not, to think about the themes that this book raises, because I think they're relevant to all of us, despite whatever your religious background. So I want to think in the short time we've got about the author, think a little bit about the series itself. So if you don't know the series, you'll get a bit of a summary. I want to think about the message, or as I've got written here, the message. I want to be slightly cautious about declaring the message or fiction. And then some final reflections from me as a Christian believer on what Philip Pullman says and how he perhaps challenges my views, before perhaps ending with a question: what would Jesus say to Philip Pullman? So let me tell you a little bit about Pullman the person. First of all, he's an English author. He's the grandson of an Anglican priest, and so he's two generations removed from an Anglican, a pious Anglican home. And he says that for him, his experience of religion was largely benign. So he doesn't have any particular story of the way his school corrupted him or his priest let him down. In fact, he adored his priestly grandfather and had a warm relationship between him and his grandson. His father was in the RAF, the Royal Air Force, and so as children they travelled the world courtesy of Her Majesty and lived in various places, including actually Australia. He spent 18 months in Adelaide as a child. And apparently to this day, still watches Neighbours every night at 6 o'clock in England, which is kind of curious. I don't think anyone here still does do that, but he's holding the flag for all of us with Australian soap operas. Anyway, I don't want to overplay this, but in a way that's similar to C.S. Lewis, Pullman lost his father at a very young age. His father was killed in Kenya in turns out he thought as a hero in a war. It turns out that the war probably wasn't very heroic. It was a colonial war where I think in the fullness of time we as the British were probably on the wrong side of history in what happened. And also he wasn't killed in that war, but in a training exercise apart from that. He only found that out in 2008. So he's very recently had to rethink some of the mythologies of his own childhood. A very literary child, I guess that's kind of predictable, and particularly loved Paradise Lost by Milton, and was kind of learned vast ways of Paradise Lost, which is the story, perhaps you know, Milton tells in poetic form of the fall of man and the Adam and Eve expelled from the garden. And so on. And the name of the series, you may know, comes from Paradise Lost, where there's Milton's description of God creating the worlds and other worlds, and he talks about God's, his dark materials with which he creates the world. And uses that in this, this story. Pullman, as goes again, is an outspoken atheist and often somewhat associated with the new atheism of Dawkins and Hitchens and so on. And he says, I'll quote from him, and I quote, if we're talking on a scale of human life and the things we see around us, I'm an atheist. There is no God here. But if you look into the vastness of space, well, I'm not sure at that level, I'm an agnostic. So he's an agnostic in the sense that perhaps given the vastness of space, there's something out there, but there's the Christian God is not here. He's comfortably atheist as regards the conventional Christian claim of God. And I want to come back to that as language, actually, to think, what does it mean to say God is not here, but he might be somewhere else? I want to just think about that as a coherent or not concept of God. So he says he is essentially an atheist, but like Richard Dawkins, he says he's an Anglican atheist. So he says, I'm a Church of England atheist, I'm a Book of Common Prayer atheist, that's the tradition I was brought up in, and I can't escape those influences. So in that crowd, well, I think is separate from that crowd in one really important and interesting way. He thinks that religious ideas or religious questions are the most significant questions. Whereas if you read people like Lawrence Krauss or Richard Dawkins, the contention of the new atheist tends to be that the questions aren't coherent questions. So the question, why are we here, where did we come from, who are we, what's our purpose? Lawrence Krauss would just say they are incoherent questions. They are not questions that make sense in our world. It's like saying, how does an orange feel? It's posing the wrong question. Whereas for Pullman, he thinks they're the right questions. He thinks we ought to ask, where did we come from and what is our purpose and where are we going? So he says, I'm religious, but an atheist. I think religious questions are the big questions. Where do we come from? What's life all about? I think that's fascinating. I think it's fascinating that he alone, of the kind of new atheist cohort, writes fiction. Christopher Hitchens didn't. Dawkins doesn't like fairy tales because they're kind of false. Whereas Pullman goes into the world of fantasy as Tolkien and Lewis and others built it in a way to before him, precisely because for some reason the world of stories and fantasies is the world that they say is the most promising for asking those deeply religious questions. Who are we, and where do we come from? So that's Pullman, the man, and I want to talk, just get you across the series. The series began in Pullman's mind. Interestingly, I don't want to overdo this, but in comparison with C.S. Lewis, it began for Pullman in the same way that Narnia began. So with Lewis, Narnia began because a picture came into his mind of a faun standing near a lampstand. And Lewis asked the question, what is this fawn doing, and where has he come from, and what's gone wrong, and why is he at a lampstand? And the whole of the Narnia series emerged from that single image. And similarly, Pullman said he was given, by the muse or whatever, he said, I began with the idea of a little girl hiding somewhere she shouldn't be, overhearing something she shouldn't hear. I didn't know who she was, or where she was, or what she overheard. I just started writing. I think, to me, it's a fascinating insight into the world of the fiction writer. So both of them have an idea suggested to them. Pullman's talked about the life of the fiction writer or the activity of writing fiction and says that the great thing about being a fiction writer is that you're the tyrant, that every full stop is yours and every comma and every verb is the subject of the noun that you want it to be the subject of. He says you get to be a tyrant in the world of fiction. And yet, fiction has this strange obedience to it, where once you see the fawn at the lampstand, or once you see the girl hiding in the wardrobe, the author has to ask the fawn, how did you end up here? How did you get here? The author has to be disciplined by what is and isn't possible and is and isn't plausible for the characters that have occurred to them. I think it's one of the great curiosities and insights of fiction that you are both a tyrant and yet you need to be submissive and obedient to the world that you create. Now, imagine describing a book to you like yourself. I want to tell you about a book where it's set in Oxford. It's about a girl whose name begins with L, and she's hiding in a wardrobe. And that's how His Dark Materials starts. But you thought I was describing Narnia. But of course, I think in a very self-conscious way, Philip Pullman begins with a girl who ends up in a wardrobe, whose name begins with L, who is the person for whom we enter into this strange new world. And I think very self-consciously goes to the world of Oxford to begin his story. It's a great thing if you know the book, you read the opening chapter, and chapter one, you get kind of discombobulated because the world is clearly Oxford. It's our Oxford. It's the university town. But the college you haven't heard of is called Jordan College. And I did actually Google it. I thought, is there such a thing? But there's no Jordan College in Oxford. And you start to realise that it's not a different world like Narnia. It's not a mythical ancient world like Middle Earth. It's our world on an alternative run of history, a kind of multiverse idea. So in the first sentence of the book, you're introduced to the girl who has a demon, and it turns out that every human in the world, created by woman, has a demon who is a kind of animal manifestation of themselves that lives in proximity to themselves, who they talk to. And over the course of childhood, your demon changes shape and context and so on, and eventually a human settles down into a fixed form like a raven or a tiger or something like that. Anyway, Lyra had that. You're introduced to her. She's got this. She's got the demon, and you start to realise that Oxford is the same but different. That it's more sexist than current Oxford or 1930s Oxford. That women are excluded from more places than they were back then. You realise that technology is different in this world, so people get around not on aeroplanes but on zeppelins, and yet in other ways they're advanced about the world. They've worked out what dark matter is, and they've advanced in areas that we haven't. And there's a, in some weird configuration, the papacy, the Roman Catholic Pope, has moved to Geneva, and his name is John Calvin, which is in church history is a fascinating confluence. Of history. Anyway, Lyra, the girl who's the hero of the story, learns of this mysterious dust that scientists, or in this world they're called theologists, are investigating to work out. They think it's got something to do with the fall, and they go off to try to find out what it's to do with. And Lyra realizes that this experiment's going on in the north, so she goes to rescue the children who have been kidnapped for experimental reasons and goes to rescue them. And she gets there, and through a series of things, sees the northern lights, and they are part of the dust that gets you through to another world, and she goes through to the next world. The second book's called The Subtle Knife, and in that world, Lyra meets Will, who becomes her kind of partner in crime. And Will possesses this thing called the Subtle Knife, and it's a knife that can split subatomic particles, and it's a knife that's sharp enough to cut holes in our universe that you can get through to other universes. And in that story, Lyra gets kidnapped and they use the knife to get through somewhere else. And the third and final is called The Amber Glass. And you learn there that Lyra has been kidnapped by the church, or it's called the Magisterium, but it's the church. And they have heard the prophecy that she's the new Eve, and that she's going to commit another original sin, which is going to reshape the world and so on. That's why she's kidnapped. Meanwhile, Lord Astral and Will have the knife, and they go to the palace where God is, who's called the Authority, and they go there to kill God, the Authority, and discover that God is a decrepit and dying old man who is dying by natural causes. Eventually, he's put into a box, and the Lyra and Will go to open the box to rescue him, but in his frailty, he dies.
Willamira Kiss, which constitutes the new original sin, but turns out to be a good thing, which is consciousness. And the series ends with Lyra discovering that consciousness is the path to truth. A critic has said that it may be the first fantasy series founded on the ideas of the Enlightenment rather than on tribal and mythic yearnings for kings and gods and supermen. Pullman's heroes are explorers, cowboys, and physicists. The series offers an extended celebration of the marvels of science. I think this is what is fascinating about Pullman the Atheist going into the previously very religious world of fantasy, is that I think he has a great insight that the world of fiction, the world of fantasy, is the place on which to paint the canvas of meaning and the place in which, especially in childhood, even before you know something is true, to entice you to at least think that it's good. And here he kind of entices you into a world where the curiosity of Lyra is rewarded and where original sin turns out to be a good thing, and it's kind of a reverse of Paradise Lost, where the original sin is allowed to flourish as consciousness and for the liberation of the characters. I think the big themes and a couple of reflections. Massive in the book is this controlling church, the magisterium, which has its kind of control over everyone, and is this kind of confluence of Protestant and Catholic Christianity, and this big ugly mess of old men controlling the lives of people. One of the characters says, "For all of the church's history, it's tried to suppress and control every natural impulse. That's what the church does. Every church is the same: control, destroy, obliterate every good feeling." Or Mary Malone, who's a nun in the book, says, "The Christian religion is a very powerful and convincing mistake, and that's all." A ritual seems to be theme, but we'll move on from there. I want to talk finally about one thing, which is God, this figure called the authority in the book. In the kind of story of how the authority came about, the story is told that the universe is pre-existent, there's matter and dust, and the authority of God is the first angel. And as the first angel comes into existence, then when the other angels start to come into existence, and eventually humans, the authority perpetuates the lie, or presents the falsehood that he had created it all. So he says to every subsequent part of creation that I created you, that I'm the creator, and he mounts this kind of falsehood so as to declare his authority, and then he takes over the kingdom of heaven, claiming that he has a right to it because he is the creator. But one of the angels discovers the plot, and when the authority discovers that the angel has discovered that he's not in fact the creator, he banishes this angel from heaven, and that angel then leads a rebellion to establish the Republic of Heaven in the Kingdom of Heaven. As you know, the authority grows old and weak, eventually dies of his own frailty, and he dies, and here's a quote, "He dies with a sigh of relief, of most profound and exhausted relief." It's a very subversive and very powerful inverse telling of the kind of Christian story of a creator God who casts the Lucifer out of heaven from Mount of Rebellion. It exactly reverses that and creates God as the usurper of proper authority. A couple of reflections before you go and start running the world again in the afternoon. There's an Eastern Orthodox theologian called David Bentley Hart who has reflected on what has happened to our notion of God. And according to him, and this is right, the classical view of God is that God is outside of creation, that there is the creator and the creation. And what David Bentley Hart has said is in the last 500 or 600 years, for historical and intellectual reasons, God has subtly shifted in our minds from being the one who is outside creation to being just the biggest guy on the block, the one that has wielded the most power, the bigger version of us, the more powerful version of us. It's as if you're on a Word document, and you know how you can make your font go from 14 to 16 to 18, And David Henry Hart says, and this is his metaphor, but it's like we've gone control X and just, or control whatever it is, and just made it bigger and bigger and bigger. And at a certain point, when it's like 200 font, then that's God. And what David Henry Hart says is that if that's your version of God, that he's just bigger, just more powerful, just in control of more stuff, then eventually God is not your creator, your competitor. That God exists in the story as the one who competes with you for power. And so for Benny Hart, he says that nature, you know, nature's idea of the world's power is a necessary corollary of the idea of God as just the biggest and baddest guy on the block. And eventually, you have to get rid of him. It's like being in the play Hamlet and thinking that, you know, it was Hamlet and Ophelia and all the characters in the play, and God is just a very, very big character somewhere in the play. That's how Pullman thinks of God. And maybe that's partly our fault. Maybe we've failed to articulate who God is. But in Christian revelation, in Christian theology, God is not competing with you in a way that a character might be competing with Hamlet. He's like Shakespeare to the play. He's the creator of it, not a character within it. And according to the Christian story, God is not competing with us for the same turf, but rather is sharing with us his rule of the universe. And he created the humans in order to share his rule of the universe. In fact, far from being a story of a cagey and difficult God who's threatened by our existence, he, put it like this, he brings the threat online. He brings the vice regents into the creation. He brings the Adam and the Eve in this audacious plan to share his rule of the universe with them. And so I think it would be really productive way to think about Pullman is to think, if he has a God that is the first of all creation, a kind of Gnostic idea that matter always is, and that there's this God that's like a demigod competing for our attention, and if we have more, he has less, then maybe in its own crazy way, Pullman's book is a great apologetic against that God. And between you and me, not between you and me, the whole world can know this, if we can get rid of that God, so much better. Because that God is not the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. That God is a very different thing. And to move that God out of the road in order to be able to begin the conversation about the God who Jesus is talking about, the God of the Bible and Christian theology, I think it would be a very productive conversation to have. Let me come back to the run of fiction. I think it is fascinating to me that Pullman, to tell his story, doesn't write an essay, but writes a story. He had a conversation with Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they were having this conversation at the National Theatre about his plays and so on, and his writing. And Rowan Williams pointed out that in the Islamic tradition, which had extraordinary achievements in the world of science and metaphysics and so on, that tradition hasn't had a tradition of fiction. It hasn't been a major feature of Islamic civilization to produce the novel or theatre and so on. And Rowan Williams poses the question that perhaps there's something distinctively Christian about thinking that the answers to the questions and the riddles of the universe are found in a story with a hero and a beginning and an end, a problem and a solution. And I find it fascinating that he goes to story to account for those big religious questions. I think that we need to recapture the truth that actually the Bible is not fundamentally legislation, but fundamentally a story about a particular kind of God who sends a particular and very subversive kind of salvation. Thanks for your time.
Well, big thanks to Rory, and Rory's able to hang around afterwards. If you have a question that you want to ask of him, then please come down front, so we'll catch him up the back. Next week, we'll be hearing from Rory again, but on a different series of novels, a different author, The Hunger Games. So that originally was planned for a different date. Don't despair. If you've missed it, you haven't missed it, it's actually next week. So back here, same place, same time, 12:30 for The Hunger Games. See you then. Thank you.